How can we impact on vaccination rates among kids?
Looking at the impact of genes and environment on the obesity epidemic.
Can we successfully help reanimate hands and arms in people who've had spinal cord injury?
And changing the gut microbiome to address obesity and the metabolic syndrome.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on July 5th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to toss the ball directly to you for our first one this week. That's a study that you requested. It was in Nature Medicine, and it was taking a look at this crazy-sounding bacteria, I believe, and its impact on what you served up as obesity and metabolic syndrome.
So I guess I should inform our listeners first that the authors appropriately call this a proof-of-concept exploratory study. And it's that. It's a small number of patients involved, but the implications are pretty big. There's been increasing awareness of the association between the gut microbiome, that is the bacteria in our gut, and the development of metabolic syndrome. And in fact, there's been a negative correlation between one particular bacteria, Akkermansia muciniphila, and obesity. The higher this level of bacteria, the lower the risk of obesity, at least in the rodent model. In the past, we've not been able to give this particular bacteria because it's grown in an animal media. But these authors were able to grow it in a synthetic media and also discovered, by the way, when they pasteurized it, at least in the rodent, that it was actually more effective. With this knowledge, they took 40 individuals, 32 of whom completed the study, where they gave half the individuals placebo and the other half supplements that contained 10 billion of these bacteria. And they followed them for 3 months. And what they discovered is those that got the oral supplementation of the bacteria, it improved their insulin sensitivity, it reduced their plasma cholesterol, it reduced their body weight, and it was associated with less inflammatory markers. By the way, this was in individuals that were overweight and obese but didn't have frank diabetes.
All right, so I understand that this is a proof of concept study, but were there any negative side effects relative to this treatment?
No, there weren't. The 32 individuals really tolerated this well.
This idea of manipulating the gut microbiome, of course, is very attractive. I would note, however, that we've recently seen that there was a death relative to fecal transplant in a person who was being treated for a Clostridium difficile infection. So I guess I have some concerns.
You're not taking the microbiome from a particular individual and giving it to another. That carries the risk of giving some other infection and or causing an autoimmune disease. This is a bacteria that's already in the gut. Now, again, for people that are squeamish about taking the live bacteria, they use both live and pasteurized forms, and both were effective.
Okay, well, we'll be watching as this moves forward and gets into some other folks. Let's turn from here to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is a study that was taking a look at changes in California vaccination policy and how that impacted on vaccination rates among kindergartners in the state. They had three interventions that were implemented since 2014, and they have a lot of really interesting data. So I'll review just a little bit of it. Between 2000 and 2017, they had over 9 million children who were attending kindergarten, and just over 700,000 of them were not up to date on their required vaccinations. Before the interventions, they had actually an increase in the number of kids who were not vaccinated between 2000 and 2013 from 7.8%, almost 8%, to almost 10%. And that was largely in places where there were educated parents and where people were using this belief exemption. They objected to having their child vaccinated. They implemented these three things. In 2014, they said parents were required to submit proof that they had discussed the risks of not vaccinating their children with a healthcare practitioner before they could get a personal belief exemption. Then in 2015, the Department of Public Health educated school staff on proper application of the conditional admission criteria. That is, you can't bring your kid unless we provide vaccinations. And they expanded a little window so that they could catch up on that. And finally, in 2016, they implemented a Senate bill that banned all personal belief exemptions. It turns out that they took a look at what's called vaccine hesitancy on the part of parents, and they found out that even though they had implemented these different policies, the vaccine hesitancy did persist in parts of Northern California. But the upshot was implementing these policies resulted in substantial reduction in the number of kindergartners, almost by half in some places, who came to school without being fully prepared. The editorialists recommend that there ought to be a federal policy for this, especially in light of our measles epidemic right now.
We've had more measles infections reported now than we have over the last several decades. In fact, in 2000, it was thought to be eradicated in the United States. The immunization has effects not only for the children, but also for herd immunity as well. There are some children, because of their conditions, may not be able to take a vaccine, but the thing that prevents them from getting an infection is the kids around them get vaccinated. So for the parents to say, well, the federal government's infringing upon my right, I should have the right to refuse a vaccine, I would remind our listeners that a parent should not be able to make a decision that adversely affects the health of their individual child. For example, we would never say if your child has diabetes, the parent reserves the right to not give them insulin. Same with regarding vaccinations, especially when they're effective like the measles vaccine. So because the states have so many different disparate laws about how to address this, I have to agree with the editorialist that the best way to address this is on a national level.
I agree, and so does the U.S. Supreme Court. So I would just cite this particular quotation from their opinion. They said, "The right to practice religion freely does not include liberty to expose the community or the child to communicable disease or the latter to ill health or death."
And what the study you cited shows is that legislation can improve vaccination rates in children.
Let's turn to your second one. That's Across the Pond from the British Medical Journal, a look at genes and environment and how they impact on obesity.
The study actually originated in Norway. This is a longitudinal study that's been going on for over 40 years. It looked at the general population in a particular county, and this was almost 120,000 people aged 13 to 80 years who participated in this longitudinal population-based health study. And about half of them included an analysis of the genes, their genetic predisposition to obesity, and BMI. Now, let's take a step back and talk about the genetic predisposition. Because when you look at twin studies and look at is obesity inherited, there is a clear pattern that identifies that there's a strong genetic contribution. However, when we do genome-wide association studies, we have identified genetic variants that only explain 2 to 5% of the variation in BMI. So there is a genetic component. We don't understand all the genes. However, we have identified 97 different genetic abnormalities called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, that have previously been identified with obesity. So what these authors did was from before 1970 all the way up to current, they looked at the rate of obesity and looked at it with regard to genes and environment. And here's what they discovered. Obesity since the 1970s has been increasing in Norway, but particularly increasing in the 1980s and 1990s. Even young adult obesity had increased. Now it increased more in those that had the highest genetic predisposition. It shows that genetically predisposed people are at a greater risk for a higher BMI. The fact that BMI is increased for both genetically predisposed and non-predisposed people implies that the environment remains the main contributor of obesity, not genetic predisposition.
I guess this sort of puts people back on their heels a little bit and says you can't just blame your genes because you're overweight.
I think that's one of the major messages of this particular study. We can't change our genetic predisposition, but we can change the environmental things we've talked about.
Okay, let's turn to our final one. That's in The Lancet. This, again, across the pond. And so they used the expression tetraplegia, but what we would call domestically quadriplegia. That is people who have had spinal cord injuries at the cervical, at the neck level, and with consequent loss of use of all four of their limbs. In this case, they were using nerve transfer surgery to reanimate, to allow some parts of the upper limb to work again. And especially they wanted to make the hands work because people who become quadriplegic, that turns out to be one of the major things that is disabling because they can't do anything. And so they used both nerve transfer and also tendon transfer. What they did in some of these patients is they used tendon transfer in one hand and they used nerve transfer in the other hand. And so the patients self-reported that they liked that approach because the nerve transfer resulted in one set of abilities and the tendon transfer resulted in another one, and they really wanted to keep it that way.
What the nerve transfer did was allow them to move the nerve from a muscle group that they weren't using to muscles like the triceps that allow them to move their arms, and also allow them to get fine motor movement, which you need to be able to feed yourself. What the tendon transfer did was to allow them to have power in the other limb. So the combination of fine motor movement in one and power in the other allows them to accomplish the functions they want to accomplish. A couple things about this. One is, this is a relatively young group. The mean age was 27. Most of the spinal cord injuries were due to motor vehicle accidents or sports. And the nerve transfers are done within 18 months of the initial injury. And in fact, the nerve transfer best works if it's usually done even earlier, between 6 and 12 months. It takes months and years for that nerve to reinnervate the muscle, and lots of physical therapy as well. However, the recovery time is lessened with the tendon transfer because you have to immobilize the tendon for weeks and months. With the nerve, it's a relatively quick recovery. However, before you get full function, takes a lot of time. And in fact, these people were followed over 2 years. And these 13 individuals that received successful nerve transfers had upwards of 50 or 60 surgeries in total. Now, the other thing is, Elizabeth, you didn't mention, is they did it on 3 other individuals that it wasn't successful. What was it about these individuals that made the procedure unsuccessful, and can we identify them earlier so we don't have to subject them to surgery or perhaps do a different type of surgery? This is the largest study ever reported, and it's pretty exciting for individuals that have quadriplegia.
Absolutely. My goodness. To be able to render them able to perform some of their own activities of daily living, what a really wonderful thing. I thought it was interesting, though, when they asked the patients about their own satisfaction. And the numbers really are in the 63%, 58%, 33%. And there were some dissatisfactions. And so I would like to figure out, if I were going to ask the questions, how we can make that percentage satisfaction higher.
Yep. And I'm sure that all of us have expectations too. When you undergo the surgery, in our mind, we're thinking, yes, I will have normal upper extremity function and it will occur quickly. And what we discover is it doesn't occur quickly. It requires an incredible amount of physical therapy, and it's not as good as original function as well. And so sometimes it's managing our expectations with the surgery.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.